In Britain in the 1950s, within living memory, the state sometimes put men and women to death for murder. Then, as now, opinion polls suggested that most of the public supported such a sanction. There were, however, occasional cases that gave pause for thought. The execution of Derrick Bentley in 1953 under the law of common purpose, his 16-year-old accomplice pulled a trigger and shot a policeman, not he, didn't merely cause grave unease, but gave great additional force to the campaign to abolish hanging. So too, in 1955, did the case of Ruth Ellis, hanged for shooting her boyfriend, David Blakely, dead in cold blood. There was no doubt Ellis murdered him. What the British legal system couldn't comprehend was the continental notion of the crime passionnel, or that Ellis had been affected by abusive relationships with men. This inflexibility and spectacle of the state killing a woman was so shocking that no female ever followed Ellis to the gallows. The hard cases of the 1950s may not have done much to sway public opinion, but they did create an abolitionist mood among the more liberal political class, who would decide this matter. The last hangings were in 1964. The British cinema ignored the question of whether or not it was right for the state to kill murderers until the 50s. It was society's dirty work, and there was no desire to discuss it, even when the campaign for abolition picked up after Bentley's execution. There had been odd references to hanging, and in the blackest comedy of all, Kind Hearts and Coronets, the impending execution of the murderous Duke frames the action. The cinema followed the weight of public opinion, and seems not to have seen capital punishment as something to campaign about. But with the increased momentum of abolitionism by the mid-1950s, the cinema made its own contribution to the debate. Yield to the Night, released a year after Ellis was executed, seemed a near copy of her case. However, it was based on a novel of 1954, a year before Ellis murdered Blakely, though some details seem to have been crafted or adapted so the screenplay resembles the Ellis case, such as the murderess withdrawing her revolver from her handbag in the street and, with shocking calmness, emptying its chambers into her victim. A glamorous, bottle-blonde young woman, Mary Hilton, played by Diana Dawes, has, like Ellis, had difficulties with men and makes no attempt to escape justice. However, she shoots not her boyfriend, but her boyfriend's lover. The audience sees the murder, but not the trial, for the verdict can't be in doubt. The film, with the exception of some flashbacks, takes place in the condemned cell. Dawes acquired a reputation as a rather blousy, unserious actress. No one who sees her in this film, playing a woman mentally and physically degenerating through degrees of terror until her execution, could doubt her conspicuous talent. The method by which the film makes its case against capital punishment is, however, questionable. It's not in the same high class as the acting. There was a perfectly rational case for abolition. Unfortunately, this taboo-breaking film doesn't choose to make it, but engages instead in crude and manipulative propaganda, erring, whenever the opportunity arises, on the side of sensationalism. We learn, through flashback, what has prompted the killing. Mary's boyfriend Jim, a man absurd in his weak-mindedness, and who, when not gambling, playing the piano in a nightclub, or chasing other men's wives, likes, in a self-dramatising way, to read A. E. Housman, has taken a shine to another woman, Lucy. Lucy is rich and classy, which we deduce are two things that, aside from all the other factors, have upset Mary, who's made the best of herself from more humble origins and works in a perfume shop in the West End. However, Jim, who becomes more caricatured with every line, simply can't cope with the struggle that life presents to him and commits suicide in his dingy bedsit. Mary's alerted to trouble by his landlady and arrives as the police are dealing with the aftermath. There's a suicide note, which a gormless copper hands to Mary. It sends her off the deep end, because it is addressed not to her, but to Lucy. There follows several weeks of brooding, in which Mary decides that her beloved is dead because of harsh treatment from Lucy. She decides, therefore, that Lucy must die, and Jim has conveniently left her a revolver with which she can accomplish the deed. The ludicrousness of Jim as a character is part of what lowers this well-intentioned film to broad-brush propaganda. Far more morally questionable, however, is the treatment of the victim. We see her legs, of which Mary is also envious, and hear her drawling voice giving evidence at Jim's inquest, but we never see her face. We aren't invited to engage with her as a human being. We aren't asked to consider her right to life, or her family and friends' right not to be prematurely and shockingly bereaved. Clearly the director, J. Lee Thompson, who in the two succeeding years would make two of the truly great films of the British cinema, Woman in a Dressing Gown and Ice Cold in Alex, felt the case he sought to make for abolition was difficult, and nothing could be put in the film that might detract sympathy from Mary Hilton. He obviously feared that to give Lucy three dimensions and make her a human being would have done that. In this attempt to manipulate the audience, something unusual in the British cinema then, he cheapens his cause. Other aspects of his direction are more praiseworthy. The film certainly conveys the oppressiveness of the condemned cell. Apart from the flashbacks and the occasional shot of the exercise yard, the film is about the routine of the wait of 3 weeks between sentence and execution, a routine that becomes more tense and surreal the closer the scheduled death comes. The prison regime itself and its personnel are not part of the propaganda of the film. Even the strictest wardresses are kind, and one at least, McFarlane, played by one of the finest actresses of the period, Yvonne Mitchell, is stricken with grief at Mary's fate. There's the obligatory gallows humour as well. When a wardress urges Mary to eat, the condemned woman replies that they are fattening me up like a Christmas turkey. Mary herself has been established as vulnerable, partly because of her tendency to self-dramatise, partly because of her self-obsessed lack of perspective. Her family, whom we meet as they visit her in prison, complete her victimhood. Her mother is an equally self-obsessed consumptive. Her brother, doing his best to keep the family on an even keel and to organise a petition to the Home Secretary for Mary's reprieve, is hopelessly out of his depth. Her estranged husband, similarly, is completely incapable of dealing with what Mary has done. The routine becomes ever more claustrophobic. The director ensures that frequent shots of the prison clock and of the calendar remind us that the few days left in Mary's life are ticking away. Also in the condemned cell is a door without a handle that, when opened from the other side, leads to the gallows. A door that's often in shot, and which an inexperienced wardress, to Mary's distress, tries to open by mistake. And Mary has no privacy. Wardresses sit with her 24 hours a day, including all through the night, when the light must be left on. Mary asks, "Why don't they put out the light?" McFarlane gives her a blindfold, but in the last days even that won't work. And Mary notes that it's what they use for those facing a firing squad. McFarlane tries to soothe Mary with the words, "There can still be a reprieve," until the kindly governor comes to her cell to tell her, with sincere regret, that the Home Secretary has decided the law must take its course, and the execution will be the day after the morrow. It's a moment of intense distress. It's made clear, as was the case in real life, that these final moments were nearly as grim for the prison staff as for the condemned man or woman. Mary has inhabited a world of casual adultery, shallow friendships made in nightclubs, artificiality, and alcohol-fueled escapes from reality. Yet she took it all seriously. She made something vacuous and pointless the foundations of her existence, and, manipulated by others and a victim of their selfishness, she ended up so disturbed that she had to kill. Also Thompson, the director, would have us believe. The people around Mary are self-obsessed and self-dramatising too. but in that they're just like her. Never are we, as the audience, invited to take the view that Mary has some responsibility for herself and has chosen, until she fires the shot and stays to take what is coming to her, to be the plaything of others. The Americans came closer to the truth in the absurd title their distributors gave the film to drag in audiences, Blonde Sinner. The film is, perversely, a celebration of the penal establishment, in which hanging is the only relic of a more brutal age. As well as the kindness and devotion of the wardresses and the decency and humanity of the governor, there's the prison chaplain, played against type by one of the stalwart character actors of the 1950s, Geoffrey Keane. Keane usually found himself in roles that demanded briskness, strictness, and a no-nonsense approach. In Yield to the Night, he brilliantly plays a man with an impossible job, exuding compassion, understanding, and God's love. And although we discern that Mary has not hitherto been a church-going type, she is eventually glad of the support the chaplain can offer. "I came because I was frightened," Mary tells him. Keane conveys exactly the strain that he, too, is under in being a party to this death, despite a bravura performance when he attends to her at the moment she's told there'll be no reprieve. He does, however, ask Mary whether she's sorry for what she's done, and she answers without missing a beat that she has no regrets. At least we're not confused either by doubt about her guilt or by an expression of remorse. All we're asked to consider is whether it's right to allow the state, in all our names, to take the life of a proven and undoubted cold-blooded murderer. Yet we lack the information we need to make that decision in this specific case, because we're deliberately denied an idea of Lucy, and so no much less than the jury, who would have formed a picture of her innocent and accidental role. Mary tells the chaplain, with an unattractive surliness, another death won't bring her back. And since the threat of execution didn't deter the killer, perhaps those two ideas are all we need to understand what abolitionists deemed the futility of capital punishment. It might have been better if Thompson had been less bludgeoning in his direction and left it at that. We see Mary go through stages of emotion as the day comes nearer. We hear her interior monologue, hoping for reprieve, recognising the steps of the governor as she walks down the corridor to her cell. The presence of religion becomes more conscious as the film and Mary's life near their end. As the cross is put up on the table in her cell, it casts more than a symbolic shadow. There's a glimpse, as the executioner opens the door with no handle, of Mary kneeling in front of the chaplain, and of the two wardresses who spent her last night with her, kneeling too. The film ends, as it must, with darkness, after the last cigarette is seen burning in its ashtray. In its time, the film shocked, not least because there had been no official disclosure of the ritual that accompanied execution, and this was a rare representation of it. The director ensures the audience leaves Mary as she walks through the door to the gallows, perhaps conscious that he didn't wish to overplay his hand with the sight of her being hooded and the noose being put around her neck, or the crash of the trap. The film achieves its superficial purpose, which was to shock. No doubt it changed some minds. However, the more one reflects upon it, the more one feels as though one has been manipulated. The director of Yield to the Night drew some fine performances in a worthy cause, but he didn't do so entirely with dignity or with integrity.